Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, just want to remind everyone to let everyone know again that we released a special limited series this week called Welcome to the Crusades that you could find at the website, Welcome to the Crusades. We did it in collaboration with our friends over at the We're Not So Different podcast. You've heard Eleanor Yanaga. She's been on the podcast before. She is great. And we dropped those first two episodes on both the free and paid feeds. So check out that series. And if you'd like to hear us talk more about the Crusades, I think it's pretty fun. We not only talk about what happened in the Crusades, but talk about these larger processes of Western colonization, imperialism, this idea of whiteness itself first begins to really form during the Crusades and the encounter with the peoples of what we would now call the Middle East. So we think you'd really like it. And again, that's welcometothecrusades.com. Welcometothecrusades.com. I don't know if you want to add anything about that, Derek, if you just want to jump in feet first to the news.
No, everybody should go check it out. We did. It was really fun. And I think it's, if you're interested in history, you'll be interested in it. I don't really have anything insightful to add. So
well, Derek, Derek gave you the hard sell there, everyone. Yeah. That's what we call him, Salesman Derek, over here at American Prestige. All right, Derek, let's jump into the news. And let's start with, of course, the big news of the week, and that is the Iran-Israel war. So I think the first thing to do is start with a casualty and target update. And if everyone hasn't checked it now, we did a couple of series, including one free one on whether the U.S. would get into the war. So check those out as well. But Derek, let's start with these casualty and target updates.
Yeah, the casualty figures haven't moved a whole lot. At least the death tolls haven't moved a whole lot in the last few days. The Israeli death toll still stands at 24. That's the official death toll coming out of the government, with about 400, possibly more at this point, wounded. The Iranian death toll officially, again, is at 240. With scores more people wounded on top of that. I will say that there are Iranian NGOs, expat groups outside the country that are releasing their own casualty figures. You can make of that what you will, but one in particular is the Human Rights Activists in Iran group, which is based in the U.S. Again, make of that what you will. I believe gets some funding from the U.S. government, so may not be the most reliable source, but it is claiming a much higher death toll of around 640 people, 263 of them civilians, over 1,300 wounded. So higher than the Iranian government has released. I should also note that Iran is now under an internet blackout. This seems to have been a conscious decision by the Iranian government, rather, to pull the plug on the Iranian internet rather than the result of an attack. Iranian officials are saying this is being done to confound Israeli targeting systems. It's also, whether intentional or not, making it more difficult than usual to get information out of Iran. In terms of targeting. We know the Israelis have continued to hit Tehran very hard. We can talk about Donald Trump's threat to the Iranian capital, that which he made over the weekend, or on Monday, rather, as he was making his quick exit from the G7. We'll talk about all this later. That seems to have sort of jump-started or supercharged, perhaps an evacuation that was already underway. There were sketchy reports on social media, unconfirmed reports from people with relatives inside Iran saying that the capital was emptying out, that people were trying to flee such an extent that they were blocked, that roads had been overcrowded, they were blocked, which was making it difficult for people to get out of the capital. But certainly that city has taken a heavy blow from the Israeli military. Besides that, most of the targeting, and I think we talked on Monday about the fact that the Israelis seem to have degraded Iranian air defenses enough that they have sort of freedom of movement in Iranian airspace. It's not total freedom of movement, but they know at this point where the soft spots in Iran's air defense coverage are, and so they're able to move pretty freely within certain designated routes over Iran. They've been able to use that to strike targets all across the country. I think we mentioned on Monday they had hit something in Mashhad, which is in far northeastern Iran, and the kind of target that the Israelis would not be able to hit unless they had free passage through Iranian airspace. A lot of nuclear sites, several of them, related to the concerns over the supposed Iranian weapons program that no intelligence agency outside of Israel's has actually suggested exists. But the Natanz enrichment facility is the big one. I think we've talked about that. The Israelis were able to destroy effectively a lot of its surface structures. The centrifuge cascades, the place where the actual enrichment is done at Natanz, is underground, but the damage on the surface looks like it's pretty severe and included the facility's power plant. If you shut down a centrifuge that way, and while it's in the middle of operation, you can do a lot of damage to the apparatus. So there's probable damage to the underground facility as well. Isfahan, the facilities in Isfahan that have been destroyed. I just saw Tuesday morning that overnight the Israelis had hit Iran's Bushehr complex. That's where the civilian nuclear power plants are, that they'd struck Iran's Arak nuclear reactor. That's the heavy water reactor that is also a proliferation risk in the general sense, in that it produces a lot of plutonium, but Iran doesn't have any facilities for reprocessing plutonium. Nevertheless, the Israelis bombed that as well. I should note there's risk when you start to get into attacking places that have actual reactors functioning, that you could cause a massive nuclear incident. And so far that hasn't happened, but there is a concern that nuclear material could be spread by one of these strikes. So something to keep an eye on. The one facility that has been relatively unscathed is Fordow, which is also a uranium enrichment facility and is hardened specifically against Israeli airstrikes. It may not be hardened against U.S. airstrikes, and that's where we get into the possibility, I guess, of the United States coming into the war.
So, Derek, you just did a really interesting special. I think I did like a real podcast faux pas. I actually listened to your episode of the podcast that I wasn't able to be on. It was actually really, really interesting. And we sent that to everyone. So please check that out. But maybe you could give a little update on, like, there's a lot of administrative wrangling going on here. And it's really quite interesting in terms of what Trump is actually going to represent in terms of the future of the American empire. He, of course, came to prominence with a criticism of the Iraq war, even though after he supported it, of course. But and there were genuine hopes in the restraint community that Trump would adopt a more restraint-oriented approach. But what does it seem now as we record this on Thursday morning, June 19th, the administration is actually looking to do with regards to Iran?
Yeah, you can chuck all that stuff out the window. I mean, it looks like Trump is going to order an attack. Maybe not a broad attack or an extended attack, but even since Akbar and I recorded that special, it's the reporting has only gone in one direction. So we now know which you didn't know yesterday when we recorded, that Trump has actually approved some sort of attack plan for Iran. This has been reported by the Wall Street Journal, by CBS. He hasn't decided whether or not to go ahead with it, but he's approved the package, the targeting package. It's unclear how intense this would be. It may be that he's only approved airstrikes against Fordow, which, as I said, is hardened against most airstrikes, but the U.S. military does have what it calls the massive ordnance penetrator, a bomb that could theoretically get down into the mountain underground where Fordow is located and destroy that facility. There's some question about whether it can actually do this because it's never been used in combat. It's never been, it's been tested in, you know, kind of the abstract, but it's never been put to any, you know, actual practical use in warfare. And so I have seen reporting that one of the things that has given Trump pause is it's not 100% certain that the U.S. can actually destroy Fordow, and he's reluctant to order a strike if it's not going to achieve its main goal. I don't know if there's anything else to this targeting package that he's reportedly approved beyond Fordow. That's the site that the Israeli military or the Israeli government really desperately wants the U.S. to attack because, it doesn't really have the capability to damage it. It could, over a long period of time, potentially wear it down, but that's very uncertain. And as I say, it would take a while for the Israelis to achieve. So they've been more or less, you know, publicly begging the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself, to get involved here. His psychology about this, as Akbar and I got into yesterday, seems to be that he's trying to play coy with the press and the American public. He's governing by cliffhanger. Every time he gets asked about whether, you know, are you going to order something? What's your decision-making process?
Derek, just want to say, yeah. Huge insight. Like, I think this is, everyone really listens to this episode. Derek is correct, and I can't believe I never noticed it, that Trump governs like a television show. Like, he's always like, who knows? Yeah. At the end of every meeting, you'll have to tune in next time.
You don't know. Maybe I won't.
Like, tune in.
Tune in. You know, maybe this week could be the week. Maybe next week could be the week. Like, he's trying to tease something, and it's just, you know, it's gross on top of being just maddening for the U.S. president to try and govern like this, yeah, like it's a fucking TV show. He talks about this shit with matters of war and peace. It's just
like
it's
literally just a broadcaster, you know, from 1960. Really, really useful insight, I think, in understanding how Trump understands his world and the place within it. Sorry to interrupt.
I can't take credit for it. I mean, there's been a lot of people who have made that insight. Okay, fine, whatever. Sure. Trump is sort of playing coy here. But I really think that, and this was Akbar's argument, and I really think he's correct, that Trump never made a decision to green light. I mean, I'm sure he gave a yellow light or whatever, you know, people term as a sort of passive green light, but never really made a decision to back these Israeli strikes. And then on Friday, after it happened, he saw all this press coverage of, you know, how great is the Israeli military? Look at all the damage it did. Wow, we're so impressed with Israel, which is, of course, what the U.S. press is going to do anytime the Israelis attack anything through any means. And Trump saw all of that and just decided, oh, I've got to get in on this. And so he started claiming, you know, that we control the skies over Iran. We know where Ali Khamenei, the Iranian supreme leader, is. We're not going to kill him yet, but we might. Like, he's, you know, really kind of jumped on the bandwagon. But I still don't know that he's made a decision to actually engage in strikes. He's got concerns, as I said, about whether or not the U.S. military can actually pull off the one thing it would be more or less required to pull off if he did order strikes. He's got concerns about understandably, I think these are important concerns, important enough not to get involved in this, but he's concerned about, getting drawn into a bigger conflict, a wider war. Still some decisions that need to be made. I think he's getting lobbied by his other best friends in the Middle East, the Arab Gulf states, the monarchies, who really don't want a bigger regional war and have not supported the Israeli strikes, I don't think they necessarily would oppose strikes that degrade Iran's nuclear program, or even that cause some sort of shift in the regime, if that's what the Israelis are after. But they're very concerned that the fallout from that could bounce blowback on them in ways that they would prefer not to be involved. So I think he's getting lobbied from there. So there's still some people in his ear, telling him not to do this, even if the voices who are telling him to go ahead are winning at this moment. Who knows? You know, he could wake up Thursday morning, he could wake up Friday morning, have a complete change of heart. We don't know. But right now, I would say it's leaning very strongly toward the U.S. At least carrying out a limited strike against Fordow, if not more.
Well, you'll have to tune in and find out.
Yeah.
All right. And let's talk about this Khamenei and how he's responded to what's going on.
Khamenei gave a statement on Wednesday, delivered remarks on the conflict in which he rejected Trump's repeated, at that point, calls for unconditional surrender. He said Iran would not surrender. He's, threatening, severe consequences, basically, if the U.S. does carry out airstrikes against Iran, which implies at least that there will be attacks against U.S. personnel in the region, U.S. facilities in the region. Khamenei's status right now, we don't, as far as I know, I don't know where he is. Donald Trump says we know where he is, meaning the U.S. and Israeli militaries. I can't say whether that's true or not. But despite reporting over the last few days that the Israelis have talked about assassinating Khamenei and that Trump has ordered them not to do it, he's put the kibosh, he's put his foot down and said, no, you can't do that. I don't believe that. I don't actually believe he's done that. But it is possible that they know where Khamenei is and just haven't made the decision to go after him. Now, I will say... One of the Iranian strikes overnight into Wednesday night into Thursday morning did hit the Soroka Hospital in Israel. Now, that facility has been used to treat IDF soldiers, but the Iranians say it was they were intending to target a nearby military base, which the hospital is affiliated with, not the medical facility itself. The Israelis made several threats basically against Khamenei's life after that strike. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, warned that there would be a heavy price to pay after the hospital was hit. Israel Katz, the defense minister, outright seems to have threatened to kill or said that, it's time for Khamenei to go effectively. So that decision may be forthcoming, whether or not to kill the Iranian supreme leader. I don't know. But the hospital strike does seem to have set the Israelis off, at least rhetorically. Whether they follow that up with action remains to be seen. I also want to be clear that when I say the U.S. might get involved directly in this conflict, I don't mean to imply that the U.S. is not already involved. It's supplying Israel with air defense. It's supplying Israel with munitions. It's supplying Israel with targeting information, intelligence. It's all but a direct combatant. At this point, the only line left to cross is, are U.S. aircraft going to carry out strikes on their own? Is the U.S. military going to directly attack something in Iran, whether it's Fordow or beyond? I don't mean to suggest that the U.S. is somehow not involved in this. It is extremely involved in this already. But there is this one final kind of line to cross. That it seems like Trump is preparing to cross, but who knows?
Thanks, Derek. So tell us about this intelligence dispute over the Iranian nuclear program. Apparently, some U.S. intel says the program doesn't look like it exists, and another one says they don't care. So go for it.
Right. This was reported in the Wall Street Journal, which has done a commendable job of being basically stenographer to the Israeli government for the last few days. But they reported on Tuesday on this, on the so-called new intelligence that supposedly convinced the Israeli government that Iran had begun to weaponize its nuclear program, that it was actively now developing a nuclear weapon. And that in turn then, you know, allowed Friday's attack to go forward under the tortured rubric of self-defense, that the Israelis had to take action or else some at some indeterminate point in the indeterminate future, they might face an attack by an Iranian nuclear weapon. And that was intolerable to them. Supposedly, according to the Wall Street Journal and other reporting I've seen, the Israelis took this intelligence to the U.S. intelligence agencies, who determined that for themselves that it didn't suggest that the Iranians were weaponizing their nuclear program. The U.S. has intelligence community has claimed for some time that Iran has done research into technologies that would be applicable to nuclear weapons, but that it mostly stopped doing that work in the early 2000s, and that it is not actively developing nuclear weapons, and that nothing in this new package of intelligence apparently convinced them to change that assessment. Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, and the rest of the USIC kind of put a report forward to that effect. Trump has decided that he doesn't care what his own intelligence analysts say. He told reporters as much. Like, he got asked, you know, Gabbard's office put out this report that said that Iran is not pursuing weaponization, and just flat out said, I don't care. I don't care what they said. And I don't, you know, I don't have anything else to say here except to note that if he's not going to listen to his own intelligence agencies, which is fine, that's certainly a conclusion you can draw. But what are we spending $100 billion a year for if the president is just going to ignore them? I think that that's money that could be spent, better spent someplace else.
Oh, Derek, don't worry. Student loan repayments have restarted, so we'll just use the money from that to pay for this.
Well,
so
okay, there you go.
It's fine.
Great.
So Trump has quit the G7 summit early. What's going on there?
Yeah, the G7 leader summit was taking place in Canada Monday and Tuesday, and this is just sort of a funny slash eyebrow raising incident. But Trump was there on Monday and then abruptly up and left before, you know, in the middle of the summit, resulted in the summit basically getting even less than the G7 leaders normally get done, which they normally don't get very much done anyway. But Trump's departure seems to have really pulled the plug on the whole thing. He left, given the circumstances with Israel and Iran at war with one another, with the U.S. potentially getting involved, or even, you know, potentially trying to act as a mediator to engage in negotiations for a ceasefire. It was very suspicious that Trump just abruptly said, I got to go, and checked out. That led to a lot of speculation. Is he going home to order airstrikes? Is he going home to meet with, you know, to order a new negotiating session with the Iranians? What is he doing? Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, commented to reporters, I guess, that Trump was going back to Washington to try to broker a ceasefire between the Israelis and Iranians. Trump then took to social media to call Macron wrong and just complain about Macron and insult him as a publicity hound, which is an unbelievable thing for Donald Trump to say about anybody else. It was just very kind of peculiar to see this happen. That's also the evening that Trump blurted out his threat against Tehran on social media, said everyone should evacuate Tehran imminently. And people thought, well, that's it. There's, you know, the U.S. is going to start bombing Tehran, or he knows something about some Israeli plan.
He was just speaking generally.
it seems like he was crazy. Just speaking generally. I mean, it's not that Tehran has been unscathed, certainly, since then, but there doesn't seem nothing special seems to have happened that would have motivated him to make that statement. He just seems to have been talking in the abstract. People should leave. They should leave Tehran. But he did it in this incredibly ominous way. And, you know, again, as I said, you know, kind of quit the G7 summit. I think he was just bored and he hates all those guys and he just wanted an excuse to leave. There was an incident on Monday where he was like freelancing with the press and just like having a back and forth with the media, which is the thing he likes to do. And Mark Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, who is the host, was sort of overseeing, chairing the meeting, stepped in and said, I got to put an end to this. We have to have our meeting. And I think Trump was just seething after that. And probably, probably took off because he was just mad and they didn't play. The other kids didn't play nice with him and he wanted to go home. Basically, that's where we are. It was just a weird kind of weird couple of hours or few hours in there. And as I say, the G7 really accomplished especially nothing this year. So that's fascinating to see.
Let's move on to Gaza, where the IDF continues to operate, to say the least, particularly near aid sites. So, Derek, tell us what's been going on there.
Basically, like the coverage of this stuff has dropped off a cliff because of Iran and because, of course, U.S. media can only focus on one Middle Eastern event at a time. And I think a nice ancillary benefit for Netanyahu and company is that coverage of what's happening in Gaza has just disappeared in many ways from mainstream coverage at this point. You get like one story a day versus five from any given outlet, two, three, four, five from any given outlet. And it's been a real boon for Netanyahu. But they're still killing, the Israeli military is still killing dozens of people a day across Gaza. I think 140 or so over the weekend, 50 on Monday, 70 on Tuesday, just figures that are jaw dropping to see day by day and just have it be sort of shrugged off as this is the normal situation in Gaza. As you noted, a lot of these deaths have now taken place, at aid sites, mostly the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is acting as basically the IDF's targeting system at this point, or seems to be, I wouldn't say intentionally necessarily, but the IDF appears to be kettling people at these GHF sites and then just, killing them en masse. There were reports of tank fire at one site earlier this week, one of the really major casualty incidents at a GHF site. They've also taken now to whatever UN aid is able to get in, and the Israelis have opened, I think, northern Gaza, a border checkpoint for some UN assistance to come in. But people are waiting for trucks. They're waiting to unload these things and take, whatever they can get their hands on. There have been shooting incidents at those sites as well now. So they're spreading this beyond the GHF model. But really, just still a lot of despicable things happening in Gaza that I think, people need to be mindful of. This is not a separate situation. This is all one conflict. It's Benjamin Netanyahu on a killing spree to, birth the new Middle East, I guess, which will have the Israeli state and then a bunch of undifferentiated, pulverized people that the Israeli military has inflicted unspeakable suffering upon.
Really, really grim stuff. All right, let's stay in the region and let's talk about Syria, where the United States military is withdrawing from most of its Syrian bases.
Right. This is something that's been speculated about for some time, basically since the toppling of Bashar al-Assad in December and the rise of this new jihadist-led Syrian government, that the U.S. would eventually get to a point where it felt it could withdraw. Donald Trump famously doesn't like having U.S. soldiers in Syria. He tried to pull them out during his first term and was stymied mostly over the threat that Turkey would move in and wipe out the Syrian Democratic Forces group. There's still that threat is still there to some degree, but the SDF has been negotiating with the Syrian government, such as it is, and seems for right now to be still in the process of trying to implement their agreement to incorporate the SDF into the Syrian state structure, Syrian security apparatus. Which will probably get the Turks to hold off massacring any Syrian Kurds, at least for the time being. I think Trump is now back to wanting to get U.S. forces out of Syria. There are reports that the U.S. military has evacuated at least two of its Syrian bases recently and is in the process of evacuating another. Amber and Zaman at Al Monitor reported earlier this week that the U.S. military is planning to reduce its presence to a single base in northeastern Syria in Hasakah province, which just so happens to be located near all of Syria's most productive oil fields, go figure. But that the troop size would be reduced from around 2,000. Now it's not clear. The Pentagon is always a little cagey about this. But to something below 1,000 U.S. personnel in Syria. There may be some extra impetus right now to leave these facilities, in fears that if the U.S. does start attacking Iran directly, that those facilities could wind up being targets for retaliation. So that may be pushing things a bit. But the long-term plan has always been, I think, for Trump to draw down the U.S. military presence in Syria. So, if the situation with Iran is affecting this in any way, it's probably just on the timetable level rather than, changing any policy plan.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Let's change things up a bit and let's go over to Thailand, where the government seems to be on the verge of collapse. I was thinking maybe we should do an episode on this. We haven't really covered Thailand at all. So, Derek, maybe give everyone a little bit of an update.
Yeah, I think we covered this here. Maybe we didn't. I don't know on the show, but the Thai and Cambodian militaries had fought a skirmish along the border, which is not terribly well defined. It goes back to kind of the French occupation, the border between these two countries. It's been drawn and redrawn, at least in small ways since then, and there are disputed parts of it. There are areas that both countries claim. It's not well demarcated, basically. But there was a dispute along the border last month in which a Cambodian soldier was killed, despite having had a couple of high-level meetings to discuss that situation, try to ease tensions. Tensions still remain high. The Cambodian government has taken a case to the International Court of Justice, the UN's so-called World Court, which the Thai government opposes. It doesn't recognize the ICJ's sovereignty to decide or its kind of jurisdiction over this particular matter. And so it's opposed Cambodia doing this. The political repercussions are kind of roiling Thailand. Cambodia's Senate President Hun Sen, the former prime minister, the father of current Prime Minister Hun Manet. So quite an influential person still in the Cambodian government, announced earlier this week that Cambodia was going to stop importing some Thai agricultural products, fruits and vegetables, which raised tensions again, kind of within the Thai government and just generally. Then on Wednesday, I believe there was a recording of a phone call that was released between Hun Sen and the Prime Minister of Thailand, Paetong Tarn Shinawat, in which Paetong Tarn, the Thai Prime Minister, was heard kind of asking Hun Sen for some relief from these tensions. Could you please, this is causing me political turmoil. Could you sort of, back off and let things calm down? She's also heard criticizing the Thai military. I believe one of their border commanders, and possibly, I'm not entirely sure of the contents here, but possibly just the Thai military in general. The Thai military is still incredibly influential politically in Thailand. It controls a number of, you know, levers of power. And if it wants a government out, it wants to topple the government, it's capable of doing that, whether through another coup, which is always something that's lurking in the background. Thailand has had a number of those, particularly, you know, with respect to the Shinawats family and their history. But also it can, you know, manipulate civilian politics to its benefit. It appears to have done that after this recording was released. The Bumjai Thai Party, one of the largest in the current ruling coalition, the second largest, I believe, in the current ruling coalition, withdrew, which put the coalition very close to losing its parliamentary majority. And if it loses that parliamentary majority, it will collapse. There will be have to be new elections. If any other member of the coalition, which is very large, so there's a lot of, you know, parties kind of maneuvering here, and any one of them could make the decision at this point to quit the coalition and collapse it. So things are certainly at a tense point, I guess, in Thai politics is what I would say. The possibility of either a snap election or again a military coup seems fairly high.
Let's move over to the Democratic Republic of the Congo and its conflict with Rwanda. Apparently, there has been the approval of a draft peace agreement.
There's not a lot of detail about this. It happened on Wednesday and just sort of seemed to sneak out there. But yeah, negotiators, the technical teams from Rwanda and the DRC governments who have been working with U.S. mediation on some sort of peace deal that would, in theory, resolve the M23 conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, M23, you know, being, you know, somewhat reliant on the Rwandan military, or at least, you know, draws heavily from the Rwandan military in its operations. The thinking is that the Rwandan government should be able to stand them down if a peace deal is really reached. The U.S. has been mediating in the interests of the Trump administration's desire to start exploiting Congolese minerals. One of the goodies that would be offered to Rwanda is the right to process Congolese minerals. So, you know, the raw product would be shipped into Rwanda, which could then do the processing and sell it off and export it to the U.S. or to the West or whomever, I guess. Probably we would want some control over where that stuff goes. But they initialed a draft peace agreement on Wednesday. The full signing is supposed to take place next week, I believe on June 27th. That would involve the foreign ministers of both countries, the DRC and Rwanda. And presumably, you know, if either Marco Rubio or some high-level official from the Trump administration would be part of that, given the U.S. role here. As I say, the details are very vague. It may be one of these things that's kind of a statement of principles rather than an implementable agreement, in which case the hard part will come after it's signed, when they actually try to figure out how to implement its principles on the ground. And there's any number of things that could happen to interrupt that. They could, you know, have different interpretations of what the treaty says or the peace agreement says or what, you know, they're required to do. M23 could say, you know, we weren't party to this. We're not going to, you know, obey it, in which case the whole thing could collapse. But there's a lot of uncertainty, I would say, about this.
Let's move on to Russia, where Trump has canceled the normalization meeting.
The Russian foreign ministry announced this on Monday, that it is basically that there have been two rounds of talks so far since Donald Trump came back into office about normalizing the U.S.-Russia relationship, the Ukraine war notwithstanding. Those are apparently, or the third round of these talks has apparently been canceled by the Trump administration. We don't know anything really beyond that, other than what the Russian government has said, which is that the U.S. canceled. So we don't know why. We don't know what the justification is, or whether this is going to be rescheduled, or if it's just something that the administration decided to drop. In that case, I would wonder why, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin just had what sounds like a very friendly phone conversation over the weekend. Putin, called to wish Trump a happy birthday. It's not clear what could have soured the relationship between then and now. It's just a curious thing, I think, to keep an eye on.
Okay, let's talk about this strike on Kyiv.
The deadliest attack on Kyiv so far this year. It was overnight Tuesday into Wednesday. The Russians killed, I believe the death toll is 28 now. There's some possibility that it could rise. It was 16, but then as recovery work continued on the apartment building that was hit, that death toll rose to 28. As I say, it's the deadliest strike on the Ukrainian capital so far this year, indicative of the fact that this war isn't really going anywhere and that it's not going away, certainly. Volodymyr Zelensky, I guess you could say his credit, he gave a try anyway. He condemned the strike, obviously, and then said that Putin was showing disrespect to the United States, total disrespect to the United States, which is very Trump verbiage. So I think it's clear who the audience was for having carried out this attack in the middle of the G7 summit and, having killed so many people when Trump and company are doing so much to try and bring peace and end the conflict, all very, very much pitched toward trying to get Donald Trump angry again at the Russians. It doesn't seem to have worked, but he did give it a shot. And I think you're going to see that moving forward as Trump, there was that period where he and Zelensky seemed to be on the same page after the Pope Francis' funeral. Trump really seemed to be getting frustrated with the Russians and it all seemed to be working out to Ukraine's benefit. And then he just dropped that abruptly. And now he's back, taking calls from his buddy Vladimir Putin, and they're broing out. And so I think Zelensky would like to get back to where Trump was annoyed with the Russians. So he's going to try to do this, I think, every time some major attack takes place, and say, this is disrespectful to the U.S., disrespectful to Donald Trump. He's laughing at you. What are you going to do about it? But I don't see it working. Trump just doesn't seem to have any appetite at this point for doing anything to that would be viewed as anti-Russia.
Yeah, we'll see if the intelligence sharing stops. All right, let's move on to Trump's expansion of the travel ban.
This is still up in the air, but, people know, I'm sure, that Trump brought back, one of his greatest hits from his first term, which was the vaunted travel ban. He earlier this month imposed bans on 12 countries. Nationals from 12 countries coming to the U.S. He's reportedly considering an expansion of that list, including up to 36 more countries, 25 of them in Africa, which I know comes as a shock to everybody that Donald Trump would single out African nations for travel ban. It's sort of up in the air right now. The administration reportedly sent a cable over the weekend to U.S. embassies and consulates in these countries. And I haven't seen a full list of the countries that are under consideration here for travel restrictions, but sent a cable to the diplomatic facilities in those countries, ordering staff to, I'm quoting here, gauge their host country's willingness to improve their citizens' travel documentation and take steps to address the status of their nationals who are in the United States illegally. And it set a deadline of Wednesday for the staff to sort of make these reports back to the State Department about, whether or not they felt their host countries were doing things to meet these demands. It's Thursday now. I guess, an expansion of the list could come any time now, based on whatever response they get back from their staff, but it's certainly out there. I don't know, for me personally, it remains a mystery why anybody who isn't absolutely forced to do so would want to come to the United States at this point. Anyway, you're more than likely going to have your phone confiscated and
be kicked out upon arrival if you said anything that could be deemed as disparaging of Israel or of the Trump administration. And it may just not be worth the trip at this point, is what I'm saying.
Thanks, Derek. Again, grim stuff. I like how I sound like a game show host talking about some of the most depressing shit in modern history. All right, let's turn to our final topic, which is in the new Cold War area. This new trade detente with China does not include critical minerals for military use. So, Derek, what's going on?
New Cold War.
This is, I may be unsurprising, but the way that the Trump administration framed the agreement that they reached supposedly with China earlier this month in London was that this was a done deal, that they'd, you know, they negotiated away all of the restrictions that the Chinese government has put in place about critical minerals, the critical minerals trade, and that China would start approving, U.S. companies, export licenses, where it had previously been restricting in mostly in response to Trump's tariffs and, sort of assorted other steps that he's taken to limit U.S. trade with China. China bottlenecks critical minerals, so the so-called rare earths, but just minerals that are important for high tech, for a lot of applications in civilian and military use. And so, Reuters revealed, over the weekend, that in fact, this agreement does not cover the export of those materials to companies that are going to put them to military use, or does not address, the materials that could be, applicable to, let's say, missile design or for chips that are going to go into missiles, drones, that type of thing. Anything that has a military application has not been covered here. This is a really big deal because the U.S. military depends on imports from China to meet its, and U.S. defense contractors depend on imports from China to meet their demand for these materials. And so if that's not included in the framework, it suggests a couple of things. First of all, the framework's not going to last because Trump is at some point going to get frustrated that the military is not getting what it needs from China, even if it's irrational to expect the Chinese government to arm the U.S. military, which I think it is. Trump will most likely not see it that way. He'll feel like he's getting double crossed and that they've gone back on some commitment that he imagines that they made in London. And so the detente is not going to last in that case. The second thing is that the U.S. military is going to be struggling to build the things that it needs to build. And I think this is relevant, particularly at a time when it's shipping missiles to Israel, when it's providing air defense support to an Israeli military that is running out of its own air defense interceptors. The Wall Street Journal reported they were out or running out of Arrow interceptors, which are the long range air defense missiles that they use to shoot down things like Iranian ballistic missiles. The U.S. can't supply those to Israel because Israel builds those itself, but it can step up. It can send more ships, which it's done. It's got, I think, one aircraft carrier in the region, another one is on the way, and another one is on the way to Europe, so close enough to potentially be involved in some kind of combat operation or defensive operation. It moves missile defense assets into the region to protect Israel from these Iranian strikes. But all of these things have components that depend to some degree on the supply chain for critical earth mineral, critical minerals. And if that supply chain is under threat or is closed off even to the United States, this has repercussions for replenishing stockpiles and moving forward. How much in terms of munitions, how many munitions is the U.S. military actually going to be able to build? We'll have to see what happens here. But it's certainly an interesting thing to keep an eye on, I think.
Thank you, Derek. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Please check out Welcome to the Crusades. Again, that's just welcometothecrusades.com. And we also really appreciate everyone that's been reviewing the podcast and liking it on Apple Podcasts. We're getting closer and closer to 1,000 reviews. So if you haven't done that yet, please take the few minutes to do it. It really does help us and it gets the show out to other people. Thank you again for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.